Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, November 24th, 2020. A head teacher is found dead in Yei Town.
He was actually found dead, and up to now the police is still making investigation to get the suspects. We did not get the full details and who killed the headmaster.
And some children in South Sudan are asking the government to take care of the environment.
We ask the Minister of General Education and Instruction to include the environmental education in the school curriculum. Really, our students need to be taught environmental issues in schools.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Police and some residents of Yei Town say a body of a secondary school head teacher was dumped in a stream in Yei Town on Monday. The police commissioner for Yei River County says his office is investigating the matter and perpetrators will face justice. For VOA News, Daniel Friday Martin reports from Yei.
Local residents discovered the body of Ofimani Gofin, a popular long-serving head teacher of Excel Academy Secondary School, floating in a stream in the Lomuku 1 residential area this morning. Residents who found the body say the headmaster had deep cuts on his head and bruises on the stomach and other parts of the body. Major General Yuasa Lujang Kamba, the Yei River County Police Commissioner, says investigations are underway to determine the exact cause of death.
He was actually found dead, and up to now the police is still making investigation to get the suspects. We did not get the full details and who killed the headmaster, but we actually sent the security apparatus. We are actually making investigation to find out the suspect who killed the headmaster.
Henry Chandia, an elder of the Ugandan community living in Yei, says the local Ugandans believe the headmaster was murdered.
We are not happy as Ugandan community that someone who is a professional rendering service to the people of South Sudan has been killed in cold blood. It is really painful, and for me as a person, I need to see a good general security situation for all the people in Yei.
Edmund Gogo, chairperson of the board of directors at Excel Academy Secondary School, calls on Gofin's death a great loss to Yei River County.
He has offered himself to give knowledge to our people. With the less money, with us, together with the teachers, I think is a great loss. And he himself even, he has about 3 subjects that he teaches, you see, and that's a great loss. These guys should be apprehended and taken to the law if they are gone.
Winnie Medina, a former student of Excel Academy, says she was heartbroken to hear of Gofin's passing.
I felt so sad. This guy has been the foundation of Excel, and he has really made a lot of us progress. This guy taught me in school. He advised me in school. I just want to say condolences to the entire family, and I also encourage the students of Excel Academy. They should just pray for his soul.
Win is calling on government officials to beef up security and do more to protect civilians and foreign nationals, especially with the Christmas season just around the corner. Amule Felix, administrator for the now defunct Yei River State Government, says security agencies are also investigating Gofin's death.
I condemn this act as a government of the defunct Yei River State in the strongest terms possible. The security apparatus are on work and to investigate and find the culprits who have done this to the life of Afimani Gofin. I also want to make an appeal to the public to remain calm as we carry on investigations. This is a new happening, and we want to make sure that it does not continue and it has to be brought to an end.
A medical director in Yei River County says he is not authorized to speak to the media about the investigation. Late Ofimani has been serving as a secondary school teacher in Yei River County for about 10 years. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yei.
Authorities in Sudan have made commitments to protect children. Sudanese Minister for Labor and Social Development says her ministry is working to reform laws that guarantee rights of children. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
For decades, a known number of Sudanese children have been forced into labor and early marriages. The transitional government says that will no longer be tolerated. Labor and Social Development Minister Lina Sheikh says her government is committed to reforming all laws that protect the rights of children in Sudan in accordance with the other rights stipulated in the country's constitution. The minister made the remarks while addressing participants at a workshop in Khartoum aimed at preparing a roadmap for implementing the Child Act and talk about how to end child marriages and other issues affecting women and children, including female genital mutilation. The minister says for the last 1 year, her ministry, in collaboration with the Ministry of Justice, has been working to reform laws that protecting children.
A lot has been achieved in this regard through the efforts of regional and international organizations that has been a full support of child rights in Sudan. Their support has helped us carry a lot of reforms, including Panel Act and other related regulations.
In May this year, the government criminalized FGM, making the act punishable by law. As Sheikh says, she is aware some communities have resisted the new law, but says the government is trying to overcome the resistance by working with the key community leaders.
We need to discover the real influence personalities in our communities. We need to know who makes decisions when it comes to child issues in the communities. They need to be involved during the implementation process.
Samia Argawi, an advocate and a member of the local rights group Know for Women Oppression, welcomed the criminalization of FGM and says any parents or midwife found practicing female genital mutilation should be prosecuted in a court of law.
This is an inhuman act and it causes a lot of health complications for girls. If a circumcised girl gets married, they will face a lot of problems in their marriage and even during the labor.
Argawi rejects the notion that FGM is in any connected to religion.
It has nothing to do with religion in any way. It has nothing to do with health, as they claim that it reduces sexual desire for women. It doesn't help a girl in any way because sexual desires comes from the brain but not from the removal part.
Sudanese Director General of Police Izzedine Sheikh Ali vows to implement the law on FGM and directed all police departments to immediately implement the decision.
I'm here officially directing all our police forces across the country, including family and child protection units, to immediately get involved in protecting the child rights, being on the social level or before the law.
At least 87% of Sudanese women aged between 14 and 49 have undergone some form of FGM, according to the United Nations. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Still in Sudan, aid agencies are ramping up their efforts to assist more than 40,000 Ethiopian refugees who have arrived in Kassala, Gadarif, and Blue Nile State. Aid agencies say the number of new arrivals is expected to reach 200,000 if the war in Ethiopia's Tigray region continues. Mercy Corps has set up a health clinic in Gadarif State to treat refugees who suffer from respiratory infections, diarrhea, and malaria. For VOA News, Nabil Viajo reports from Washington.
Jens Hesman is emergency coordinator at the UN Refugee Agency UNHCR in Sudan. He says thousands of new Ethiopian refugees are arriving in Sudan every day.
Emergency refugee registration teams of UNHCR and the government commission for refugees here in Sudan by now have registered over 40,000 new arrivals from Ethiopia since 7th of November this year. So in just over 2 weeks, 40,000 people have fled to Sudan. It is an increasing refugee situation. The influx intensity varies by the day.
The refugees enter Sudan through the Hamdayat border point in Kassala State, the Lugdi border point in Gadarif State, and a new location further south at the Adarafi border point, where around 700 Ethiopian refugees cross into Sudan's Blue Nile State over the weekend. Hesman says, although UNHCR and partners are working on an emergency response plan to support some 100,000 refugees, the number of Ethiopian refugees fleeing the war in Tigray could reach 200,000 if the fighting between government troops and regional forces in the Tigray area does not end. Artis Noor is the country director at Mercy Corps in Sudan. Noor recently returned from a visit to the Umrakuba camp in Gadarif State, where his agency has set up a health clinic to treat refugees.
In Umrakuba camp, as of yesterday, we had more than 6,500 individuals who have been living in that camp now. And Mercy Corps is providing critical health services, urgently needed health services, through a health clinic, which is basically a primary health care center. And we are providing outdoor consultations. And also, we have also established a referral facility. So we have an ambulance which can take patients who are seriously ill, who require next level of care.
Noor says many of the Ethiopian refugees arriving each day in Sudan need critical medical attention.
On an average, we are seeing between 90 to 120 patients each day. Most of them are women and children. And the most common illnesses that we are seeing are upper respiratory tract infections, diarrhea, and malaria.
On top of the large influx of refugees from Ethiopia, Noor says, Sudan is still dealing with the effects of devastating floods, and the country is now experiencing a second wave of COVID-19.
Both of these factors, coupled with the economic situation in the country, have created a lot of difficulties for the government of Sudan in general, but the people of Sudan specifically. The government was already struggling to meet the humanitarian needs in the aftermath of COVID-19 and the floods, and now it has to deal with the refugee situation as well. So this is going to stretch the already meager resources that the government of Sudan has.
Both Noor and Hesman are calling on donors to increase their support so that Mercy Corps and UNHCR can assist Ethiopian refugees fleeing war in their country. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at COVID-19 therapies. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
can you share an inspirational quote and where you heard it from?
Heavy rains are a reminder of challenges in life. Never ask for a lighter rain. Just pray for better umbrella. I just came across it while I was reading something on social media.
This quote I just added from a church. The father was like, "For those who seek, always find. And so fight endlessly for what you want for the future."
Friends are like buttons on the lift. They either bring you down or take you up. I heard it while I was in secondary school and it stuck since then.
وَمَنْ يَتَّقِ اللَّهِ يَجْعَلْ لَهُ مَخْرَجًا. Whoever fears Allah will have solution to whatever problems. It is from the Holy Quran.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and U.S. Centers for Disease Control say coughing and sneezing can spread COVID-19. Physical distancing, staying at least 1 meter away from people outside your family, can protect everyone. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. And in our Tuesday health segment, we take a closer look at how COVID therapies work. Several companies have found a vaccine to protect people from COVID-19. Dr. Rajesh Gandhi is an infectious disease physician at Massachusetts General Hospital, Harvard Medical School, and a member of the NIH COVID-19 Treatment Guidelines Panel and the Infectious Disease Society of America COVID-19 Treatment Guidelines Panel. International Edition's Steve Miller asks Gandhi about the treatments for the coronavirus.
That's a good question. So bamlanivimab is an antibody. So what's an antibody? An antibody is a protein that the body makes to fight off infection. And so what the producers of this antibody did is they found a way to make just a targeted antibody that binds the virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, binds the outside of the virus and prevents it from getting into our cells. And the hope is that it'll work as an antiviral, as something that you know, disables and prevents the virus from reproducing itself or making new copies.
So this would be something that if you tested positive for COVID-19 and you are infected with the SARS-CoV-2, the novel coronavirus, this is something that would be administered for you if it's approved for use.
That's right. It's a treatment. So it's different than a vaccine. Vaccines are something that are used to build up the body's own immune system against the virus and to prevent someone from getting virus. This is after someone has been infected, they test positive. Right now it's authorized, not approved, but authorized by the U.S. FDA to use in outpatients, people not sick enough to be in the hospital who have mild or moderate COVID-19. So they're not people that are having low oxygen or sick enough to be in the hospital, but they're people who have milder disease, some symptoms, and the hope is that this antibody will prevent them from getting sick enough to be in the hospital. So far, the studies that have been done of bamlanivimab are relatively small, a few hundred people, and so they're called phase 2 trials. They're not the definitive trials that prove a drug works, but the FDA thought that there was enough information that they authorized its use. My hope is that more and more trials will allow us to figure out if this drug really does work, and most importantly, who it works in. Right now, it's been authorized for high-risk people, but we don't yet know enough because the trials have been too small to answer who is it most beneficial for, and those are the kind of studies that still need to be completed.
Dr. Gandhi, remdesivir is another antiviral antibody medication. What's the difference between it and bamlanivimab?
Remdesivir is another type of antiviral, and that's been used to treat hospitalized patients. So unlike bamlanivimab, which is used to treat people who aren't yet in the hospital, milder disease, where remdesivir has been used in people who have been sick enough to be in the hospital. There is a bit of controversy right now because the WHO, the World Health Organization, just last week recommended against the use of remdesivir, whereas the U.S. guidelines have largely endorsed the use of remdesivir in hospitalized patients. I think the key difference here is remdesivir is not a home run. It doesn't reduce the likelihood of dying of COVID-19. And that's what the WHO was looking at. But what remdesivir does is it speeds up recovery. So even though we can't yet prove that it does the ultimate good, which is to prevent death, it does speed up recovery. And as our hospitals in the United States fill up, many of the U.S. guidelines panels, I'm a member of them, I feel like remdesivir does have a role in speeding up recovery. So that's kind of what's going on with remdesivir. As far as vaccines, vaccines are a really hot and important topic. These are to prevent COVID-19, so healthy people get it before they get sick. I think there'll be kind of an intersection. So vaccines will be used to prevent COVID-19, but they're not yet available. And in the meantime, those people who are getting COVID-19 do need treatment. Most COVID-19 is this mild to moderate that is not severe enough to be in the hospital. And that's where we're hoping that these antibodies, hopefully that'll prevent people from getting sick.
That's Rajesh Gandhi, an infectious disease physician at Massachusetts General Hospital, Harvard Medical School, and a member of the NIH COVID-19 Treatment Guidelines Panel. He spoke to International Edition's Steve Miller. Children in South Sudan are calling on the government and communities across the country to do more to ensure a clean and green environment for the country's future. The children made the call last Friday as South Sudan joined the rest of the world to commemorate World Children's Day. For VOA News, Ding Magot reports from Juba.
As part of events marking World Children's Day late last week, a group of about 20 children collected garbage around Juba's Customs Market area and planted 250 trees at Buluk A2 Primary School in Juba. A mature leafy tree produces as much oxygen in a season as 10 people inhale in a year. The children also produced radio public service announcements which were heard in all 10 states along with writing blog posts, poems, and opinion pieces that were published across the country. Daniel Sabri Emmanuel, a 15-year-old Senior 2 student at Juba Christian Center Model Secondary School, says he wants the government to educate young people about the environment and how to protect it.
We ask the Minister of General Education and Instruction to include the environmental education in the school curriculum. Really, our students need to be taught environmental issues in schools so that as one of the events we are conducting, like the tree planting event, trees need to be planted at school to avoid deforestation and other soil erosion.
Daniel is asking the government and communities to protect the country's natural resources, including forests and wildlife. The children also ask South Sudanese to produce less trash and ensure that trash is regularly collected and recycled. Loika Christopher Arcangelo, a 12-year-old student at Ustratuna Primary School, says the government should promote the use of clean energy like solar and wind energy.
I want to ask the government to increase their awareness on children. And the second is to produce wind energy gases so that it will help us children and our parents. Yes, so that they will not cut down trees and so that South Sudan will be clean and green.
Andrea Suley, the deputy country representative for the UN agency UNICEF in South Sudan, says although South Sudan is not listed as a major contributor to climate change, the country is heavily impacted by the consequences of climate change and extreme weather events like floods and droughts.
It's alarming to know that there's 850,000 South Sudanese people impacted this year by floods. This is the reason that we cannot ignore the call that the children are making today for a clean and green environment.
Joseph Africano Bartel, the Undersecretary in the Environment and Forestry Ministry, says the government is taking steps to ensure a clean and green environment for future generations to minimize the impacts of climate change.
As members of the Paris Agreement, we as a country have come up with our nationally determined contributions, and in those contributions we have two sections. One is mitigation and the second one is adaptation. In mitigation, we as a country are going to plant 100 million trees in 10 years. We all know that 99.9% of our population use fuel wood and charcoal as a source of energy, and that is putting a lot of stress on our forests. So the next thing that we'd like to do is to make sure that we have an energy policy that is clean and green.
Bartel also says the ministry will adopt climate smart resilient agriculture. He says the government will conduct research to learn the best areas to plant crops and will produce farmers with accurate information about seeds and farming as the climate continues to change. World Children's Day, which was last Friday, celebrates the anniversary of the adoption by the United Nations of the Convention on the Rights of the Child on November 20th, 1989. For VOA News, I am Ding Magot in Juba.
The resilience of journalists who brave arrest, attacks, and repressive legislations was celebrated at the annual International Press Freedom Awards on Thursday, hosted by the Committee to Protect Journalists. The 2020 awardees are from Bangladesh, Iran, Nigeria, and Russia. VOA's Press Freedom Editor Jessica Jarrett has more.
Protests, violence, and coronavirus-related restrictions. Journalists have never been so tested as this year, says Courtney Raj of the Committee to Protect Journalists.
on top of the kind of perennial threats that you have to journalists and media outlets around the world, from censorship to imprisonment to murder, you now have a global pandemic which has fundamentally reconfigured economic, social, political systems, and you've never needed journalism more.
This year, the committee honored journalists in Bangladesh, Iran, Nigeria, and Russia, who have shown the importance of independent media amid great opposition. Journalists like Dabo Olorunmi, co-founder of Nigeria's Premium Times. Arrested twice for his reporting, Olorunmi says the media are working in more restrictive environments.
We have about 28 constraining laws in our statute that just make the work of journalism a very difficult and nervous experience in the country. Increasingly, too, I think with the whole developments around cybercrime in the country, we haven't some of these really crazy laws that then criminalize the work of journalism.
Laws around the use of electronic media and false news are also a problem in Bangladesh. Photojournalist Shahid Alam says press freedom there has gone downhill.
We were under military rule at one point. That's when I had a loaded gun pointed at my head. When democracy came, we thought things would change, but this is by far the worst it's ever been. I think we live in an environment of fear.
In Iran, where access to independent journalism is limited, freelancer Mohammed Masood covered corruption, economic sanctions, and protests on his now suspended social media accounts. Sharif Mansour, Middle East Program Coordinator, CPJ.
We and a lot of journalists around the world have relied on people like Mohammed in times of crisis. He's providing a service to Iranian citizens and to the international community at the same time. And for him to be jailed just for stating facts under those dubious charges is just shows how the Iranian government disregard of media and of journalism in principle.
Because of her work, Russian journalist Svetlana Prokofieva was convicted by a court in July of justifying terrorism. Despite the risks, she remains committed to journalism.
What we do is normal and should exist in a normal society. But if we abandon our profession, stop what we do, then our country, our society as a whole, will be even further from normality, from civilization, than it is now.
With journalism under threat, the work of international lawyers like Armel Clooney is ever more important to defend press freedom, says Raj.
The recognition of Armel Clooney with the Gwen Ifill Press Freedom Award this year really recognizes the symbiosis between the legal community and the journalistic community. We need each other.
With press freedom under attack, that support has never been more important. Jessica Jarit, VOA News.
That's all we prepared for you this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Dunia by Soraya. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask if you must leave your house. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.